Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So, exciting gaming news. As of today, Wizards of the Coast announced that they were going to reprint a premium special edition of original D&D White Box.
Ooh, cool.
I kind of thought so, until I saw, like, the price. I'm like, $149.99.
Yeesh. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Coming soon, D&D White Box. Nostalgia has a price.
You know, even if it was cheap, I don't think I'd buy it. I don't think I'd even go for a PDF. I'm not really that interested in first edition.
Well, here's the thing. And, like, I don't know if the picture on the website was an actual photo of the product or if it was kind of those, you know, artist renditions to show you what the product may potentially look
of
like.
Of a box.
Well, no, because they had the box open and they showed the contents.
Yeah.
And, you know, they said, okay, you get this special, you know, box with new artwork. The original 7 pamphlets are in there with all the original artwork, except the covers are different. And looking at the photo, it looked like they were just kind of 8.5 by 11 papers, you know, folded in half lengthwise to make these little paper booklets.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was hard to tell scale, but they're not bound books at all. They looked like paper packets, which didn't really impress me. And maybe I'm wrong, because again, maybe the picture is misleading, but I would not spend $150 for 10 dice, 7 digest size paper booklets, and a box.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a collector, so I probably wouldn't be interested anyway, but I'm sure somebody who's a fan of first edition and likes having maybe a complete set of stuff, they'd probably get for it. So, to each their own. I might jump at the red box for nostalgia. That was my first one, but not for $150.
No, they might come out with that one for $150, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be nice if they came out with like a more reasonably priced version.
Mm.
I think a lot more people would get that.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing this is just going to be a stopgap, but I certainly hope this is not going to be the way things are going to come, or the way things are going to be from now on, where they just release like first edition stuff after first edition stuff.
I think they actually are. I mean, that seems to be their plan. You know, just release old stuff or special editions of old stuff until, you know, D&D Next takes off.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine to do it until that comes. But, I mean, you're going to eventually run out of this nostalgia thing. You're going to run out of things that you can reprint.
I don't know. How many re-editions were there of the Star Wars movies?
Well, that's George Lucas, you know. Hey, at least George Lucas added something to the movie, even if by adding something he made it worse. But
exactly, he took it away by adding.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm looking at some information on like collectors. There's collectors information like on different printings. So like the first printing, the first alpha, the first beta. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about hobbits. Yeah, they actually called the halflings hobbits.
I thought they did.
And the tree on sense.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did they get sued?
Yep. In the 6th edition.
Mm-hmm.
They had copyright conflicts with the Tolkien estate.
Huh.
So then they changed to halflings and treants.
Nice.
There you go.
Oh, references to Balrogs, Nazgul, and several mentions of Tolkien himself. Okay.
That's going a bit far, eh?
Hey, well, didn't the original deities and demigods have the Cthulhu mythos in there?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure they did.
They did. I remember the book, though. I remember all the Greek and Egyptian gods, but I don't remember the Cthulhu ones.
It was in some of the earlier stuff, but I'm not sure. That probably caused some problems, maybe. But, I mean, Lovecraft was pretty open with
sourcing out his stuff.
Yeah, sourcing out his stuff. I don't know if it necessarily made it public domain. But another problem was they used Michael Moorcock's Elric deities as well. So, I mean, that's definitely a problem.
Well, continuing on the D&D hate rant, as I usually do. So, the latest Legends and Lore article by Mike Merles kind of addresses healing. You know, they say they're looking at healing, and they were having lots of discussions whether or not clerical healing should be a necessity in the game, or whether there should be options, you know, if you don't have a cleric in the party, since most of the adventures and most of the stuff is built on the assumption that you'll have those 4 regular character types in the party. And... Mm-hmm. the ultimate decision they came to seems to be, we'll give you a lot of optional rules, but we're not going to say any of them are right or correct, and it's for you at the table to figure out. I don't know, to me it felt like they've identified a problem, because consistently on the feedback things, people are unsatisfied with healing, and they're unsatisfied with hit point totals and, you know, how much damage the monsters can take. So it feels to me like their solution is, hey, you guys deal with it, which doesn't really feel like a solution to me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can definitely see the where they were going with all of those different options. I mean, like the fourth edition, they came up with those healing surges and the partial rest and the full rest, and as an answer to one of the most common criticisms, which was the 15-minute workday. There was, I guess, healing has been a problem since at least third edition, probably going back further, but I couldn't say. But so it makes sense that they would want to try and create the game where you could do self-healing or some kind of interim healing without a cleric. But at the same time, having a cleric, having that healer in your party is very, you know, traditional D&D. So there's probably people who wouldn't want to forego that aspect of it. So I can see the idea behind giving them both options.
Yeah, that's true. But I think another part of the problem is, like, okay, granted, I didn't like 4E, but it had a consistent flavor, superhero. And everyone was Wolverine and could heal everything within, like, minutes. Yeah. But at least it was consistent. You know, third edition, natural healing was a lot slower, but at least it was consistent. At first level, in both of those systems, you kind of knew where your character was on the power scale. And I remember a previous question and answer, you know, on the internet. Somebody asked, hey, we've seen third edition, we've seen fourth edition, can you tell us what the power level of a first level D&D next character is? Kind of, where are they in the fictional world? Because, you know, fourth edition characters were well above average people, and third edition characters were kind of average people. And they didn't give an answer. They gave a non-answer. They said, we want it to be variable. We kind of, you know, want it to be whatever you want it to be. And I said, that's a cop-out. Just tell us what tone this version of D&D wants to do. And if they had done that, I would say with healing, okay, fine. They've told us what the baseline is, and they've given us optional rules for healing. But it seems to me like they're just putting too many variables in. Oh, you know, the power level is whatever you want it to be, and the healing options can be whatever you want to use at your table. It's like, how about you just build a basic game so everybody can be on the same baseline, you know?
Or, you know, they hadn't decided when the question was asked, so they didn't want to give an answer.
Well, then say, we can't address that right now.
So they don't have a default?
Nope. From the what I have read, they do not appear to have a default. Oh. Or they want it to be whatever you at the table want the default to be.
Well, I remember there was some talk way back at the beginning about speculation about Wizards trying to make it kind of a universal fantasy role-playing game, kind of like a GURPS for fantasy. So if that is the way they're going, then I could see it being a collection of optional rules that you build your own personal campaign out of. But that said, I don't think that's actually going to happen, because they had a lot of success with their, what was it called, the big role-playing where they put out, like, editions in game stores all over the place.
Oh, like D&D Encounters or Lair Assaults or whatever their Wednesday night delves like or things like that.
Yeah, it was like tournament D&D games. Sorry, I don't remember the name of it. But anyway, that kind of thing. Anyway, they had a lot of success with that, so I'd be really surprised if they didn't put out a basic standardized edition that you could still play with that.
Yeah, exactly. I think we said that way back in the beginning. It's like, if you have an optional system, such as GURPS, you can't then have organized play without setting a standard.
And RPGA, so, sorry.
Okay, so RPGA. You can't have RPGA games without saying which optional rules are being used so that everything has a standard. And then why not just make that the baseline?
Yeah, I don't know. But then again, all of this said, it's still a game in progress, so who knows where it'll go. That's really the same criticism that I've had all along. I don't think that they're doing very well with this open testing. I think that was a poor decision.
Well, how else are you going to maintain interest for, you know, 2+ years?
Reading Legends and Lore, it sounds like they are going to go with default rule.
Even if they haven't decided what it is yet, eh?
Well, maybe I'm wrong.
It'll probably be clerics are involved in the healing. but it's not decided yet. But what they're just saying is, with the core game, is our aim is to err on the side of simplicity and streamline, easy to learn rules. So they'll have a default rule, but they're not going to say that it's right or correct. And then there'll be optional rules for people that don't want to rely on the cleric if that is the actual default rule.
Or vice versa.
He's saying that it's pretty split as far as the play test feedback, so that's why they haven't decided what to do. And their goal was to remove cleric healing as a necessary element of adventuring.
Which makes sense, because it's always so hard to get somebody to do play the cleric.
But why? Why can't you play the cleric? What's wrong with the cleric?
Well, most of the games I have, you know, it's always one of the first questions is, who's going to play the cleric? And somebody's like, oh, all right, I'll do it.
I like the cleric, yeah. Anyway, it sounds like they're going to do a default. I don't think D&D could ever be a truly generic system.
Right.
For a lot of reasons, or even be a truly generic fantasy system.
I agree, and I wouldn't want them to be honest.
Right, because it never has been. It's always been like a class system. And as soon as you have that, you're only going to be so generic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think with classes, a lot of things are built in, and you have to account for that. So
it has to be, because it's kind of that layered template thing. So if your templates don't mix, then it blows up the system.
Yeah, I don't think they can rewrite the rules in the respect that, you know, if you look at the other generic systems out there, like basic role-playing or GURPS, they are all point-buys. Mm-hmm. And they say you can be anything, and they're right, you can be anything. If somebody wants to make the Green Lantern and a fantasy cleric and a wizard and a SWAT team guy, they can all do that in the same party. It would make
then
sense.
Then they play Rifts!
But even Rifts doesn't claim to be like a generic system. It's like, right, they've got that standard system, but you always got to, like, okay, and here are the classes in which to play these, because we're built on a class system.
Hmm.
So, yeah. We were talking about this over lunch yesterday, I think it was. And part of the problem is Mike Merrill's has got to crank out two of these a week. But I think even just once a week is a bit too much. And I think we're just too needy for information right now with the internet and open play tests and stuff.
It's just, yeah.
You know, update me constantly. And I honestly, like, take a couple weeks. Update me with stuff that is relevant. I mean, I think one of his Legends and Lore, or something, it was like the first two paragraphs were about the weather.
Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, yeah, here it is, last week's, after a stretch of cold weather. Like, who cares?
He's being conversational.
Yeah, all right.
Because he has to write a post.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, on today's episode, we're going to do what could be the first in a series called Pimp My Game, or not. We'll see. And the idea is we'll take problems that game masters have and offer some suggestions. Now, of course, we'll be doing problems that we've encountered. And if anybody has encountered problems that we, of course, are not mentioning, then please write in or mail in. And we'll then talk about them on an episode.
And hopefully pimp your game. That was the point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Wayne got into a forum argument with, was it one person or a couple of people?
I think it was at least two.
Throwing down.
And it was about metagaming.
Yeah, it came up in a conversation about, the person was asking, why can't just players roll dice? And, you know, it came up, certain situations came up where, you know, sometimes a dice roll will inform a player, and they'll take a action with their character that's inappropriate. So I think the example being used was, people are searching a dead body for clues, and the person or the player searching the body gets a very low roll and asks to roll again, only because they, the player, know that there is information to be found on the body because of the low roll. It's kind of the example of, well, the GM let me roll, therefore there must be something here to find, otherwise the GM would have told me to not roll, and I rolled low, therefore I want to roll again because I know there's something there to find. And I said, that's metagaming, and if that happened at my table, I would not allow the person a second roll. And someone chimed in with, well, what about intuition? You know, characters get intuition, and maybe they just know there's something there to find. And I said, that works in real life. That doesn't work in a game, because from my perspective, you cannot prove to me that your character got this flash of insight or intuition, and it's not player metagaming. So I'm just going to have to blanket say, no, I would not allow that at my table. And, yeah, the discussion kind of went from there.
So then Wayne brought the discussion to us.
As you can hear.
And I've given it to the listeners. So the circle is complete.
So we're just going to end here. Just tell us about your descriptions later.
We're hoping third time's the charm. So what we've done is we've taken the top three aspects of metagaming, or the top three problems with metagaming, and some examples, and the way that we would deal with it. Now, we should say that we are going to be arguing against metagaming. So,
just a heads up, if you want to stop the episode now.
Yeah, if you came to the episode hoping to find out how to metagame more, you'll be a little bit disappointed. So we are going to say is, yeah, metagaming happens, and sometimes you can't avoid it, but here are ways to avoid some of the main causes of it. So the first thing we have, and this is touches precisely on what Wayne was talking about, is players using knowledge that their characters don't have.
Which is like the
yeah,
classic,
I think this is probably the most
example
common,
of metagaming
thing that I've seen at the table, or done at the table for myself.
And so kind of, I don't know, the other example is searching for the secret door. Well, the GM let me roll, therefore there must be one here. I'm going to keep searching until I find that door.
Well, I think the first thing is just the assumption that just because a game master lets you roll, because you've said, I search for a secret door, or I search the body, or I search for something special, a clue, just because a game master lets you do it doesn't necessarily mean that it's there.
True.
And it's just like, well, we'll hesitate to say real life or like in the movies or in TV, you know, just because somebody searches for something doesn't mean there's actually something there. You know, a police officer has a search warrant, doesn't mean that they'll turn up anything.
It does on TV, usually.
It depends on what kind of story they're trying to tell, but yeah.
Okay, yep, fair enough.
That's something that I go by exclusively in my games, is that if someone wants to perform an action that has a skill attached to it, yeah, let them roll. Even if there's nothing to be found there, let them roll and just think that the difficulty target number is too high for them. And actually, vice versa as well, if the players are trying to do something maybe like sneaking across the courtyard, for example, even if there's no one there to hear them, I'll roll the opposing dice just to keep up tension.
You know, I don't disagree with that strictly because some players will metagame. You know, mm-hmm. the GM let me roll, therefore there must be something here to find. But on the other hand, as a GM, should you always have players roll even if there's absolutely nothing for them to find or nothing for them to fail?
I mean, if it's going to begin to a case where we're just wasting time, where there's rolling, if I can just say, guys, there's nothing here, you can stop rolling now, then of course we'll put that. But if there's a chance that it's going to build tension or going to create drama or mystery, then absolutely. And that's, you know, that's something that I should probably mention for this, is that I think from what we were talking about earlier with metagame, is I think I have a little bit different perspective on it than you guys, maybe, in that I'm more okay with players metagaming as long as it keeps the game fun, as long as there's tension being built or, you know, emotions happening at the table, even if it the immersion in the story decreases a little bit.
I'm going to disagree a little bit. I'm going to say let them roll whenever they say.
Okay.
And what you can then do is to incorporate some real time, because, yeah, it can cause the game to drag along. But like searches, whether you're searching a body, searching a room, searching for a secret door, that takes time.
Mm-hmm.
So allow it to take time and not necessarily like just, you know, go out, you know, leave the room for a while and watch, you know,
watch. Take a smoke.
Yeah, yeah. Watch a TV show or something. Just say, okay, this is going to take about 30 minutes. So, yeah, roll.
Well, then you're getting into LARPing.
Doesn't matter. No, but like saying, okay, this amount of time has passed in the day, and when they're finding out that they're always having to, like, let's say if they're playing Vampire, and I use that as an example because there's very much a limiting factor of the daylight.
Right.
And if they're finding, it's like, okay, now I got to find a place to sleep again. Great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then that's a very natural consequence to the constant rolling and searching.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't limit them, because if their character is, let's say, paranoid, and they walk into every room and they're like, I search for stuff. All right, go for it. Yeah. Oh, okay, go for it. Now, of course, a dead body. I mean, if it's a war zone and they're searching every dead body, all right.
Eventually, you're going to get shot. There's your consequence.
Yeah, you got 50 of them. Go for it.
Yeah. But, you know, you're probably not playing one-on-one, so there's always the other players to say, come on, man, there's nothing freaking here. Let's move.
But that... I guess it's a good point. Like, sometimes the players can, or the other players can police the person who is metagaming, as you just said, Chris. You know, like, great, especially in, like, a fantasy campaign or, like, any kind of group. Yeah, that one person who is searching the body, what are the other players doing? Are they just standing around doing nothing? Well, I guess kind of maybe combining Lyle's point is not to be, like, an adversarial GM, but maybe point out to the other players in character how long this is taking and how much time the other character is wasting.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are some times when, you know, the rules of the game and, you know, the actions the players are taking, they can come into conflict where it's not very realistic in any case. Though, specific one I'm thinking of is with, in D&D, with a thief trying to pick a lock. If they fail at picking the lock, then they can't pick that lock again until they raise a level. And there's not a good in-game reason for it. So it's hard to not pull that as a metagame kind of thing. And I think this kind of bleeds into the searching for a body. You know that you've done poorly, but you can't do it again. I can see from a player's perspective how it might feel unfair, even if, like, by the spirit of the game, it is actually fair.
Well, again, I'm going to disagree. Mm-hmm. Because if you search a body, let's do that one first. Like, you search the body, and, like, they've turned up no evidence. The character, how are they supposed to know that they failed the role?
You're absolutely right. I agree completely with that.
And now with the picking the lock, I don't necessarily think that there is some sort of in-game conflict or contradiction in that, let's imagine a thief and they pick a lock and normally it takes a minute.
Mm-hmm.
A copper lock takes 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But at a certain point, they fail. Now, what you're assuming is that one roll is like they didn't pick it in 5 minutes, or sorry, in 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
But just say, look, it was a tough lock, you tried, and you can't pick it. You failed. Like, not you failed that first time to pick it in 1 minute, you just failed entirely.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like, okay, now you have 6 hours, okay, walk away, take a breath, you know, go to the bar, come back, and hey, try again. You know, maybe you'll be able to do it. But it's kind of like in the movie, it's like that whole attempt, that whole hacking attempt or whatever you were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that one roll encompasses all of those different attempts. It's not that first enter in a password and it fails. It's all of those attempts.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, but it still chafes me a little bit. And don't get me wrong, like, I understand the need for it in the rules, but it's kind of... when you try this and you try it again and again, it's just not working. Eventually, like, this is too difficult for me, and you give up. But you're not making that choice to give up. The dice is making that choice for you.
Well, I guess, like, but isn't that what the dice roll represents? Like, and I used almost exactly the same argument that you did, Lyle, when I was having that sort of forum discussion. And the real world example, or another real world example I used, was like the Where's Waldo books. You know, like, you know, Waldo is somewhere on that 2-page spread. Sometimes you simply cannot find him, and knowing he's on the page does not make finding him any easier. And I sort of said, okay, mechanically, what you did is you opened the book, you made your perception roll or your search roll, whatever, and you failed. He is not popping out the page to you. You don't know where he is. Knowing he's there does not make finding him easier. You failed, you don't get to roll again, unless the situation changes, unless you close the book, go away for like a day, and then come back. So I kind of had the same, you know, the same argument that you did, Lyle. I was like, no, sometimes you are not going to be able to do this thing, and that's what the dice roll represents. And I said, unless you could give me an airtight reason as a character why the character thinks there is something else here to find. Not the player, but, you know, the character. Or the situation changes pretty substantially, I would not allow another roll. Sorry.
Can I just add to that? This isn't the Special Olympics. Like, you're not rolling the dice for effort. You're rolling for dice to see whether or not you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fail, you fail. It's not like, you know, hacking takes, you know, 20 attempts. You're not rolling the dice for every attempt necessarily. You're rolling the dice to see if you succeeded. I don't think it's the dice's ending the effort, because it's irrelevant. It's not an effort challenge. It's a skill challenge.
Right.
It's saying you cannot succeed. Finished. Unless you bring something else to the table, you go and get another hacker to kind of help you or something like that, then you failed. Now, if you look, I think the body is really easy. It's like you search the body. As far as you are concerned, there is no clues on the body.
Right.
And actually, you failed that die roll. That there actually could be no clues on the body.
Yeah.
But that's irrelevant. What's important here is that as far as your character is concerned, there are no more clues on that body.
Right. Or there were never any clues on that body.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The lock on a door. As far as your character is concerned, that lock is unpickable. That firewall is unbreakable. As far as your character is concerned. So they need to not go away for a day and close the book. Although I get what you're saying, Wayne. I 100% get
it. I was looking for a way to say you have to change the situation.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. It's more than you go and get a friend to help you look for Waldo.
Hey, can you help me find Waldo in this book?
Sorry, Simon. I'm a little stumped on this puzzle. Oh, yeah, sure. I love puzzles. Oh, Jesus, Waldo book? What? So I'm going to disagree somewhat. But I understand what you're saying, Chris, because I think that's how a lot of players perceive it. They see it as an effort thing, and it's not an effort thing. It's an ability thing. And
yeah,
the dice just said...
I still chafe against it.
Okay.
Well, I can understand that, because people don't like to fail. And that's what the dice said. The dice said you fail, and some people don't like that, so...
No, it's less of a failure. It's more of the idea that I have to give up now.
Well, you don't. You know,
exactly. You go and get a battering ram to take down the door.
You know, a game master should get like some blank dice with nothing on them. It's just like, oh, you go, well, I don't give up. And you're like, great, roll these dice. There's nothing on them. Great. go for it, dude. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah, here's your participant ribbon.
Yeah.
But yeah. Now, I think it's just like the dice are telling you that you failed and you gotta deal with it. But
yeah.
Because do something else.
Going to combat, I mean, I guess it's more acceptable to fail, even though people curse, because you get another chance to swing your sword the next round.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the monster's not going to die when you miss it, unless the other players kill it. So, I can see that, but a skill challenge and like a combat are divided differently.
Right.
The skill challenge is kind of like the entirety of that attempt, whereas combat round has got to be separated into like 6 seconds or 1 second or whatever the rule set is.
It's also easier to see in a combat sense because it's physical and action-based. You know, you swing your sword, you miss. It's very easy to visualize that. It's, I suppose, you know, I can't personally pick a lock, so it's harder to visualize being unable to succeed at this task, or at least for until I gain a level.
Well,
which is also a Wayne. Which is also a bit of a nebulous thing, you know, to feel that this lock is unpickable. That's it. I can't do it. And then maybe a month later to say, you know what? I think I could give it another try.
Think of it like a math problem.
Mm-hmm.
Some math problems you're able to get right away. It might take you a little bit of time, you know, but you know the formula. You're able to plug everything in, and you solve the problem. And then some problems, you're like, you know the formula, but you're plugging in the wrong numbers or whatever, and it's not, you know, not working. And I've had some experience, like when we're doing like some like finance stuff, and you're like, these numbers at the end of my calculations should balance. There's no reason why they should not be the same. And it didn't matter how much I tried. It just wouldn't balance because I was missing a skill. It didn't care. The math problem didn't care that, oh, you're trying really hard. Oh, maybe I'll make this easier for you. No. It just didn't matter. And it's like, because picking, you know, most of us aren't criminals. So, like
most of us.
Yeah. Hacking or picking a lock or we're not, most of us haven't seen a dead body. So, all of those things, you know, but think of those as math problems. And it just doesn't matter.
You know, that's a really good example. I think not so with math problems, but I don't know how this will resonate with our listeners in America, but, you know, being here in Japan, having to learn the language, I've been in that situation on several occasions where, you know, I'll be trying to buy something at a store and asking, I don't know, for example, asking for the price. You know, 2 months ago, I wasn't able to ask for the price of it, but hey, now I can. That's awesome.
Yeah, or sometimes you do it and they still just look at you because they're not expecting you to speak Japanese.
But... True.
That is a good example because you're reaching the limits of your skill.
Mm-hmm.
And you can try and try and try, but like the effort is not going to suddenly make vocabulary pop into your brain.
Yeah, but the convenience store isn't going to be like, you know, give you whatever you're trying to buy because you put forth a really good effort asking for, you know, if there was something in that.
Oh, he's trying so hard.
I have no idea what he's saying. Well, I'm just going to, like, just start offering him money.
Because you know. I think he's trying to hold me up.
Like, going back to the skill thing and how you said that, you know, players are more accepting of failing in combat. Like, really, if you think about it, combat is really just a very long in 4E's case, a very long extended skill challenge with multiple roles.
Mm-hmm.
It's, can you get more successes than the opponent before time runs out? And that time runs out is your hit points, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I think most games have rules for extended skill challenges, right? Like D&D had it, like Ubiquity has it, World of Darkness have it. I think every game has extended skill challenges or tasks that take longer than a single die roll. So mm-hmm. why not use those in more situations? Okay, great. This lock, well, you can tell this lock is going to be really difficult to pick, and it's going to take a while. And it's not resolved with a single roll, it's resolved with several. And each roll represents a certain amount of time. A minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever. And you can try until your time runs out and the guards show up or that gelatinous cube slides down the hallway, or you go until you accumulate enough successes to open the door.
Yeah, and you know, you can represent that physically in the with just the lock itself. You know, maybe it's got several locking mechanisms, or it's one of those paranoid people's doors that has like six locks and deadbolts going up and down the side.
Yeah, exactly. And I get what you're saying, Chris. Like, yeah, people are more acceptable of failure in combat because they can try again, because over the entirety of the combat, eventually they're going to succeed. Or they're going to die, you know?
That was more Lyle's point. For me, what I was saying with combat is just it's the physicality of it. It's because, you know, if you fail at the lock, nothing has really changed that much about your environment. The lock's still there, you're still there, and neither one of you is going anywhere because you can't get through the bloody lock. But in combat, you know, you've missed. You've put it forth the effort of your sword. It's missed its target. Now the enemy is coming back at you. Same thing if you were doing a skill that was like an athletics thing, trying to swing across a river or something on a vine. You know, you throw all your effort into this one action. And if it fails, then, you know, the vine's gone backwards. You've fallen into the river and are being carried downstream. It's much different than it is, you know, standing in front of a locked door where nothing has changed. So that's what I was trying to say with why combat is easier to accept. But
another problem that we talked about that comes with the same situation is there the other players notice the failure.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore they say, okay, well, I'll try to pick the lock or I'll try to search the body.
Oh yeah, that. Yeah. Oof.
And again, this is something that it can be metagaming, but I'm going to argue that it also can be done very naturally in character, and that the characters get frustrated with each other and say, oh, you're useless, let me try. So what do you guys think about that?
Ah, yeah, because that was also something we were talking about with searching the bodies. You know, if you know you've rolled poorly, then you can just say, hey, Joe, why don't you try searching the body?
Like, I have no problem with it if the character says, oh, I didn't find anything. Yeah, Joe, why don't you check it? You have maybe better skills than I do, or you've been on the force longer, or whatever. For whatever reason, I think he might do better. Mm. If that's done in character, I have no problem with it. If the player looks down and says, well, I rolled crap, someone else do this, then I have a bit more of a problem with it. And as you said, Lyle, if it comes up naturally in the game where another character says, oh, get out of the way, you don't know what you're doing, you know, I'm a police officer, you're going to contaminate that body, let me check.
Sorry.
You know,
I'm just thinking about just, sorry, that's not the way it works in the real world. It's like the crime scene investigation unit comes in and it's like, all right, guys, how about the paramedics have a first crack at this? then the beat cop, and then the detective. Then we'll come in if there's anything left. We'll try our...
I realize that's not how it works. I'll use a different example.
I'm going to be a little pessimistic here, and I'm going to say there's no way to avoid it, because it doesn't really matter what the initial character says. Everybody saw the failed roll, if you're allowing open rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And that anybody could then conceivably come up very naturally say, well, let me try. And they don't really have to make a strong case. I guess if you had a modern world setting where it does very much have the crime scene investigation unit check something and everybody just kind of stands and watch and they collect all their evidence. But even in the movies or TV, you see the the detective go, and what about this?
Yeah. Did you guys check his pockets?
Right, and you know,
like, oh no, we didn't. What the hell? What the hell's wrong?
And it's not like anybody's going to be playing the pizza delivery guy standing there. Oh, let me try. Yeah, why don't you have a try?
Natural 20. Oh yeah.
So yeah. This is one of those things that I think that it's really tough to avoid if you're going to have open roles.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a really simplistic point, but one thing I found that helps me out with it, at least, is just the way that you present the effect of the role as the GM, instead of saying it absolutely, saying it in the perspective of the character. So, for example, when they roll their thing, you don't say that there's nothing on the body. You say you don't find anything on the body. Same thing, you know, with the perception checks. You know, now you don't hear anything. So if they're trying to check if somebody's lying, yeah, it sounds like he's telling the truth.
Yeah, I like trying to do that wherever possible, too. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Lyle, it is kind of difficult to stop that kind of metagaming as a GM. So I would say if you're a player, if your character would not reasonably be able to attempt what you're attempting, maybe you should police yourself and not go for a role. Play your character. As you said, hey, I'm somehow the pizza delivery guy with these cops and detectives. I don't know anything about searching for a body. Let me not ask for a role because it's not playing in character.
No matter how much it sucks.
Exactly.
Stupid luck.
Exactly.
All right, so we're going to move on to our next point. But before I do, is it really clear to listeners that we're saying you can't make that second role?
Yeah, or, you know, if you do allow a second roll, then it doesn't change the effect.
Don't allow a second roll.
Even if he rolls well, nope, nothing there. Nope, still nothing there. Sorry.
Again, I'm gonna disagree with you, Chris. It's like, well, why let him make
it? I just can't get it right tonight.
Follow the script, dude. I send you a script every day before we...
Now, as an effect of the metagaming, you know, if the player is insisting on rolling in because he know he did crappy, then don't let it change the thing. Just let him roll as many dice as he wants. Eventually, the other players will get angry at him. But, you know, it also depends on the way you're playing. Before, we were talking about the mysteries, playing mystery games, we talked about something out of the gumshoe system where every time that there is some kind of clue to be found, the players automatically find it. And how well they roll depends on how much information about that clue they get.
Right.
So it's not a necessarily, you know, black and white situation, but you can vary the amount that they find. If they're insisting that there's got to be something on the body, just maybe throw them a bone. You know, if it's not that useful.
That's an amazing rule. And whenever you can incorporate that role, please do, because it's really good. I think that's Robin Loss, and he comes up with some amazing stuff. My only thing is, what if there's like only like one minor thing to find on that dead body?
How
do you parse that
track
into?
They actually say for the gumshoe, you cannot make the adventure until you know what your characters are, because then you look at the skills and you say, okay, they have two levels in whatever, chemistry. Therefore, I have to prepare enough information for them to get if they choose to expend those two levels of chemistry or whatever it is.
That's why
the GM actually has to have that information ready.
That's why I said the gumshoe system is fantastic when you can incorporate it.
Right.
But a lot of times you can incorporate it. I mean, if you're playing a dungeon crawl, it's not a mystery.
Mm.
You know, so maybe some of the clues that you would get are pretty basic, you know? A lot of people are playing published adventures.
The tunnel goes down.
Yeah, it's like, go left or go right. And you're like, well, it's saying middle. What? No, that makes no sense. What?
I'm going to search this T-junction. Great, one goes left, one goes right. Which way do you go? I look again. They're still going the same direction.
You've got a clue. Go in a direction.
My advice here, if players are rolling to decide whether they go left or right, you need to hit somebody.
No,
and you don't mean in the game.
Tomb of Horrors, dude. Well, it's not left or right. Remember Tomb of Horrors? And there's like a skeleton.
Right.
And it's pointing to a door. And you go through the door and you die. And the skeleton was like warning you. It's like, no, don't go through that door.
No, the skeleton was just being a jerk.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I'm going to die. Everybody dies. Start trying to write, like, don't go through the door in blood. And he's like, screw it. All right. Well, it's been a while since I played Tomb of Horror, so if I've gotten that wrong, you know.
I am sure we'll come up with a reprint soon.
Oh, they've been a few times. Like, I don't mind the reprints. So, you know, hope that it didn't come across in the introduction. I don't mind all this reprinting. I think it's fantastic. I just really hope Hasbro is not totally given up on
producing new stuff,
because they're only going to go so far on this reprint stuff, and then they're just going to, like, all right, D&D is over. because Hasbro's there to make money. They're not there to fuel your nostalgia. And eventually,
unless
all
it makes them money.
No, yeah, but eventually we're all gonna die off, and that's it. You know.
Then we'll be the skeletons pointing to the door.
Damn. Damn. Imagine that. It's like D&D doesn't outlive us. Damn.
That's the saddest thing I've heard all day.
Yeah. Need a box of tissues.
Go to bed with that, people. Go to bed with that.
Are you trying? Hey, we want our listeners to wake up the next morning.
Right now, I don't want to get up.
This would be a huge rash of, like, what?
Oh, it's going to outlive me.
Monoxide poisoning? Committed.
Actually, that's why I eat the amount of pizza that I do, because I don't want to outlive D&D.
Committed suicide on your giant bed of all these, like, reprints and old editions. Oh.
It was worth it.
Now, the second big metagame problem that we identified was players not playing the character that's actually on the character sheet.
And I think we need to kind of, not preface that, but I think we need to clarify by saying...
Because it'd usually be after.
Yeah, all right. Don't need D&D as a reason to kill myself. That would make too much fun to me. No, I was going to say... I was going to clarify, the player is... most often playing someone who's better than what's on their character sheet. I don't think we've run across many people who hamstring their character.
No, no, sometimes it's worse in a certain respect. Well, the leader example is a person playing somebody who's actually worse than they are in a certain aspect. And that example is, you know, usually at a gaming table, you have people who are more charismatic or more of the leader type. So, if that player opts to, let's say, make a character with a lower charisma score, either for the role-playing possibilities or because they wanted to min-max the attributes, which is fine, and they might even, like, their heart might be in the right place, and they want to play a guy who's kind of going to stand off in the sidelines and not be the leader, but they can't help themselves, and they play the leader.
Hmm.
They are the leader of the group. People look to them, and they respond accordingly.
Yeah.
So that's an example of somebody playing somebody who, in that respect, is worse than what they are normally. But then, as Wayne says, a lot of times, yeah, you are playing somebody who's much better. And a good example would be, like, intelligence or wisdom or the skills surrounding that.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought of the charisma example and the way you presented it, Lyle. I had thought the player intentionally used charisma as a dump stat to min-max other stuff and then still wanted to play the leader of the group because... sometimes in form role playing, but in games that like don't have those social mechanics, well, I can use my own player skill.
Well, I was being nice by saying that the heart was in the right place. A lot of times, people,
which sometimes it is.
A lot of times it is a dump stat, and they just then go, "Well, because I don't really need to stat out my social stuff."
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That one I think is harder to correct, and you don't want to be like a jerk DM, but. I don't know, maybe the thing to do in that case is to say to the, you know, the player who is not playing their character, say, great, hold on, such and such over here is the mage with a much higher intelligence, maybe don't say much higher, you know, such and such over here is a mage with a better intelligence, why don't you let him have first crack at the puzzle?
You know what I'm going to say? Make the leader play the leader. That's one way around it. They hand you the character sheet, and they're like, well, I'm going to try to play this guy. And you're like, are you going to be able to play this guy?
Hmm.
Are you going to be able to play the wallflower?
So if someone does play the wallflower and can't shut up, what do you say? I don't hear you.
Well, you know, with the leader, I mean, I think charisma maybe isn't the best example of that, because I could see someone playing an uncharismatic leader. But the larger point there, that if somebody's lacking in leadership skills, they probably won't make a good leader.
Because they're playing with a bunch of slaves? What is it?
I
bought you all.
if it was, for example, like a military campaign, or if the whole group is going along and following this guy as a leader, even though he didn't put points into it.
But that's rank. So, then there's something else there. Then the person would have paid for rank.
Exactly. And that's what I was saying, why I agree with the larger point. I just didn't think charisma was maybe the best example of
it. You guys and your hair splitting. Jesus.
Hey, I haven't split hair today.
I've split several. It's a little bit more difficult than what we were talking with before about using player knowledge outside of what your character has, because with that one, it's usually in connection with the GM, like we said, picking a lock or searching a body. But this one has to do with the other players a lot and their interaction. You don't really have as much control over, or really any control over, what they're going to do and how they're going to react. in the case of a leader situation, the only way you could really kind of fight back against that is either to talk to the player and say, hey, cut it out, or make NPCs not react to him well, so he's not a good leader.
Well, I think that kind of gets to the example Lyle was saying of have the leader play the leader. And like when we played the pulp game, right, one character or one player had to be the man, you know, and it ended up being a little more everyone was equal, but I specifically had NPCs not react to people who were not the leader in that. You know, like Lyle was playing the female and we were playing 1930s pulp, so of course the NPCs were going to kind of default to the white male as the leader, which is what they did. So I kind of agree with Lyle's and your, Chris, point about, hey, have the leader play the leader, or have, you know, the quiet guy play the quiet guy. And as you said, Chris, you can't really dictate or you can't control what the other players are going to do, but you can you as the game master can have NPCs react appropriately to that character, and hopefully they'll follow suit eventually.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a good point. That's one way to do it. And it's also a good example in that particular game, the players force themselves to like respond or defer to the leader.
Right.
I remember there was an argument about what the next course of action was.
Whatever you say, it is.
Yeah, and then the guy who was playing the leader spoke up, and then Chris, who was one of the guys arguing for a certain course of action, just immediately deferred to him and said, whatever you say. And that's something as far as the metagaming goes, it's like everybody's got to be involved in that.
Right.
Because it could be the leader has, whoever played the local, who's done the low charisma person could really be trying to be, you know, the wallflower, or they could be trying to play the system. But if all the players and the game master are deferring to whoever is the leader, then it completely kind of balances things.
Right.
Yeah. Undermines things, and it's just that. Now, as far as like the intelligence things, and that was a problem, and I'm saying this as a person who played a dark conspiracy campaign, as the detective, and I wasn't the smartest person at the table. I wasn't the best person to be the detective. And, you know, I put pressure on myself trying to think of, like, really creative ways to, like, break into places and stuff like that when I could have just thought of a much easier way with the other players. Like, why don't you just do this? I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. And, you know, sometimes you're like, yeah, you're probably not the best person to play that. You know, because then it just becomes you're very much reliant on your roles. You're not adding things.
Right. So let's get back to your point of do some research as a player for your character a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It's been made before, but it's worth saying again.
But I want to use the example of Yujiro, who played a very stupid character, and Yujiro is somebody who contributes a lot to the overall discussions, but the effort was there in every game to try to play the dim character.
Mm-hmm.
So when he occasionally, perhaps even unintentionally, broke character to offer some really, really good advice in a dim voice, in a stupid voice, but still, it's like really insightful. Then it was very easy for everybody kind of, you know, jokingly go, oh, wow, that's, you know, out of the mouths of children or whatever we said.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because he was so consistent, like he tried so hard in all the other scenarios that when he occasionally, like, you know, thought, you know, I really love puzzles, so I'm gonna like throw in a few ideas on this one. Then everybody would be like, all right, cool. And I don't think that's a problem. It is breaking character in a sense, but for the most part, the person was trying to play in character.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah.
So the last point that we discussed for metagaming is about players who play the game as a game and not as a role-playing game. People are more concerned about what the dice and what the mechanics say than actually getting into their character. And this, you know, this one is something that we had quite a bit of back and forth about, because there are some situations dealing with some systems where the mechanics are based on how you're role-playing. The example Wayne and I were speaking of earlier is Monster Hearts, where you can, by role-playing these situations where you gain influence over a person, and dice rolls are included in this, you can gain what are called strings, which allow you to spend an influence on them, you know, to get promises from them, experience points, etc. So it's something where there is some metagaming required by the system, but at the same time, it's still gaming the system. So
yeah, this one's kind of hard because, as you said, there are some systems that that's how you play the game. Like, the other one that came to mind was Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, where you want to get plot points to do cool stuff with your character. And to get those plot points, sometimes you have to do things mechanically that, you know, have your character do things that they wouldn't normally do, or would be kind of dumb. Or, like, getting fate points, you know, you have to accept a compel, or, you know, do something kind of stupid for your character to get those points. But you, the player, want them because they'll allow you to be awesome later on. And I guess the what makes it difficult to separate is that we're players, but we're also an audience for the story. And in well-designed systems, putting your character in those bad situations or making those stupid choices enhance our enjoyment, I think, enhance our enjoyment as an audience, even though there's something our character maybe wouldn't do.
No, that's a good point. I mean, it's a game, so people want to play the game, but it's a role-playing game, which is a completely different animal.
Right.
And I think, you know, I'm going to say this, it's kind of depressing, you know, back to the carbon monoxide in the garage, but maybe that's just why, like, MMOs have taken over. It's like people can go, hey, I just want to play a game.
Right.
You know, I just want to kill rats and whatever. But, you know, you know, role-playing game isn't about that, you know? It's like, it's about...
playing a role? Hence, role-playing game?
Damn, that was the word, you know, it's just like, where'd you get that word from? It's like, hey, you're playing a role. And that was a really good example, just to use the superheroes. It's like, plot points are really cool. That's a really cool part of the system, and it allows you to have a lot of flexibility. But, you know, unless you're, and if you're playing the Human Torch, there are a lot of flaws in that character, which could cause you to play the character to get those plot points. And maybe think of that, and definitely metagame when you're making your character. Chris kind of touched on something towards the beginning of the episode about, you know, when you're making your character and that, but, you know, while he was saying that, I was thinking, it's like, no, definitely metagame, but as you're putting stuff down on that paper.
Right.
And you make yourself a character that you're going to like to play, and that's why I don't have a problem with min-maxing, but also something that, you know, games the system in a way that's going to make you happy.
Yeah.
But as long as then you then play true to that character. And if you want to make yourself a superhero and you want to make yourself Captain America, but you can't play a flawless character, then you make the U.S. agent, which is like a more flawed Captain America, if you think that'll help you get those plot points.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely. And that's why systems that have disadvantages like GURPS or Savage Worlds are so wonderful for that. You can, when you're building your character, you can use those to squeeze a few extra points towards your powers. But man, when you're role-playing, you know, playing a guy who only has one leg or something like that, it can bring a lot to your character. I don't know why I chose that example, but yes.
Well, and not to bash on D&D again, but you saying, you know, in systems that have flaws or in systems that, you know, the mechanics work in such a way where you need to put your character at a disadvantage to get something that'll help them later on, you know, compare that to D&D where there aren't flaws, and there really is no incentive to put your character, you know, or to have your character make stupid decisions or do things other than maybe like role-playing rewards, which you should be doing anyway. But in a system like that, I think it's easier to play the game as a game than systems where it's that kind of thing is built in and encouraged.
No, I'm going to disagree with you. I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay.
Dang it, me too. You go first.
All right. No, go, man. Because I've been the voice of dissent here, so go for it.
No, actually, I was just going to say, it depends a lot on what system you're playing. Like we were saying with Marvel or with Monster Hearts. But with D&D, it's especially 4th edition, it's almost impossible to escape that game aspect of it. Because once a combat starts, and face it, it's D&D, there's going to be a lot of combat. You know, out come the miniatures, out comes this grid on the table. You know, it's from that point, it changes into a board game of sorts. You can pretend to be yelling something heroic when you're throwing that D20, but it's still all about which power you're choosing.
I believe the heroic thing you would yell is, woot!
Exactly. You know me too well.
Well, my set was slightly different in that in Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, they have something in the system, which is great, the plot points, and ways to earn it, and who haven't seen that, it's really nice. It's a nice, elegant system and very flexible. But D&D doesn't really have a system to play up the disadvantages, so there's no incentive to do dumb things.
Right.
So there's no incentive to metagame doing dumb things.
Yeah, I'll generally agree that it is a good thing in like a well-built system. But yeah, sometimes, again, that game of Marvel Heroic Roleplaying we played, as the Invisible Woman, I now realize I should have done some stuff, but at the time I couldn't really justify the wants of the player with what the character would do.
Okay, well, here's a question that I just wanted to ask you guys in general. Are there any situations where being gamey, coming out of the roles, or a kind of metagaming is okay? The specific example I was thinking about was in a previous game we had, I had some coded messages for the players. So I kind of put them out there on the table and allowed everybody to gather around and work on these messages. And some of the players were playing more intelligent characters, some were less intelligent characters, but I kind of let everybody, well, I made the decision to just not really allow characters to be in it, to let the players just kind of work on the puzzles. And I wonder, you know, at the time I was thinking it's pretty cool because everyone seemed to be really into it, but it definitely wasn't a role part of the role-playing game. It was very much on the game side.
I don't know. I think that's different. Like, I think that was immersion, right? Because that's something you did outside of the system to enhance the play experience. So I really liked it, but I don't really think that's a good example. When you asked the question, the game I immediately thought of was Time and Temp, where you roll those dice and you pick a number and you enter that number on the matrix. Mm-hmm. That's how the game works. And there's a little bit of it worked into the fiction where, you know, you kind of have this thing that supposedly your characters have this thing that looks like a remote control and the numbers will light up and that's how you get sent through time. But you cannot get away from the players writing that number onto the grid. The game won't work without that. And I don't think that took us out of the game strictly because the game doesn't work without it. So I think there are some systems or some games that are designed with that in mind, and it doesn't really matter that you're taken out, in which case the metagaming in that example isn't really that much of a bad thing.
Well, when you get into the heavy mechanic stuff, combat specifically, it's almost impossible to avoid some of the metagaming that goes on there. Like if you're in a combat system and you say to, I want you to move over to this side and duck down so that I don't blast you with my fireball, or something. I mean, that's metagame. You're not actually yelling that out in combat, because your enemy would probably hear and be able to anticipate you. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with that in my mind. That kind of strategic planning.
It just because it overlaps with the Yujiro point we made earlier, and that Yujiro contributed perhaps more than he should have in character, but because he had played everything else in character, it was a nice break, you know.
Yeah,
but
right.
Like as you said, it was a nice change. You know, a way for the players to just enjoy themselves as players. And that's fine, you know. I mean, that's what the Game Master set up. And I think, you know, metagaming is only a problem if the Game Master thinks it's a problem. Or the other players think it's a problem. So if the Game Master sets out one metagaming task, then I think that's fine.
Yeah, actually, that was a comment that I read on a forum when researching this topic. Is, you know, one person said, I don't really believe in metagaming. It's all just whether or not the group has agreed to the style of play or not.
It does raise the point where, hey, when you sit down at the table, maybe you better hash this stuff out, you know, because not everybody has the same definition of metagaming, or it's acceptable to certain degrees where, you know, one GM may totally allow you to, like, completely plan your battle as you're kind of moving the miniatures around, where another guy might say, hey, you know what, your characters, yeah, you're yelling all that stuff in character, and the bad guys know, and they're going to take advantage, or what you just said is way too long for that 6-second turn, so try reining it back.
A novel in a look.
Yeah, no, you cannot convey a novel in a look as hard as you try. And, okay, go ahead and roll the dice. Nope, you still failed, and no, you can't roll again. You hit the limit of what you can say in a look.
You know, that's a good point, and I think what you've done by saying that, and it's just something that we were talking about before the episode, and I didn't see how it fit, but I think I see how it fits now, and that's a point that Chris raised about, you know, somebody who doesn't describe their actions. So whether or not that is a problem, and I think that's one of the things where metagaming, if we define, it's like, I do 10 points of damage, if we define that as metagaming, then that is one of the things where it is a lot grayer,
right?
And you probably the ideal is a combination of the two, because you couldn't just do one, and you shouldn't just do the other.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I said this at luncheon, when I ran those Dungeon World games, right, that's a very narrative game, but there was no way I, as the game master, whatever, you didn't even play, dude, shut up. There is no way I, as the Game Master, could fictionally say, and it does 10 points of damage to you, other than saying, and it does 10 points of damage to you. Right? So I could describe, yeah, you know, he swings his sword, breaks across your chest for 10 points of damage. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can say that fictionally. Unless you play the Secret Fire, and then you get hit for damage. Oh, it's an end dash. Crap.
You get hit for extreme damage. Yeah.
You know what you do? You make whatever, like, you call it hit points. You call it, like whatever you want to call it. Like, mega damage capacity. I guess his character would be like, oh, he does one, you're dead. or standard damage capacity, whatever. But you make that as, like, part of the world's lexicon. So they actually talk about themselves in hit points. It's like, oh, I'm so tuckered. I must be down 5 hit points. Tough day at work. Oh, yeah. The boss, like, rode me for, like, 10 hit points.
I heard that in the live cast play I was listening to. Some cleric went up to another player. So if you were to quantify how you're feeling right now, between what percentage would you say?
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. That one's tough. And I think it's good to encourage players to say more than I swing my sword. Or even more, you know, like, fighters get such a bad rap, but even, like, to the, you know, the wizards, like, I cast a fireball. Yeah, cast a little with a little flare there, dude.
Hey, you know? I ran into that problem when we were playing 4E. How many times can I have a beam of light come out of my staff, you know, and describe it interestingly? You're just like, oh.
I guess. When you get down to those at wills, it's just one card, yep. card.
I zap him.
It's a sunny day, and my light captures its rays and focuses them. I'm sure you could do it a few ways. It's a cloudy day.
Yeah, a few ways. And as Chris said, when
it's
you
a cloudy
get to,
day,
your,
but
your,
I think the
your
fire
tenth
flies.
Description, it's pretty lame.
Well, I mean, it's not like swinging the sword gets any more. Like, there's only so many ways you can describe that.
Yeah, true.
It's like, I come at him high, I come at him low, I come in from the side. I thrust, gave my offhand. Okay, how many different, you know, from 11 o'clock? Saying 11 o'clock, is that okay, cool. All right, so metagaming was a problem that we identified, and like we said, it might not be a problem for you. I mean, you might love it.
In which case, you're playing wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so send us our email, and then we'll politely send you an email back. But if there are problems in your games that you wouldn't mind kind of brainstorming with a group of people, then send it in. And Chris, what would be the best way to send that in?
At current, either email, which is info@idleredhands.com, or post to our Facebook. The comments have been closed down for the moment. We had a little bit of trouble with somebody breaking into the website and leaving some messages in our code last week. So I turned those off for the moment, but hopefully as things get cleaned up, we'll be able to turn those back on. Same thing, the forum, we've had a lot of problems with spam too, so that's been shut down temporarily. We're discussing what to do with that, but it will be back up before you know it, so...
But like Chris said, in the meantime, send it to our email.
Or post on Facebook.
Or post on Facebook. We do have a Facebook group where we also post all our episodes.
Mm-hmm. Aside from that, check us out online, www.idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode on the website through iTunes, through Stitcher, or through DriveThruRPG. And as we just mentioned, there's Facebook, Twitter, email, and eventually forums as well. But we'll look forward to hearing from you and hopefully with some ideas on how to pimp your game. So I'll see you next time. Bye.
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 Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG, the one true source for RPGs. Oh,
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.